Good Wednesday afternoon. This is Ozarks at Large for April 7th, 2021 on your public radio station 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Ahead this hour, an election. Yes, time for another election, this one in Bentonville. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda will have the details. And later, a new mural is emerging in Bentonville. We'll go on site with creator Wheezy. After our show, on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston, former Stanford Dean Julie Lithcott-Hames wrote a book about helicoptering parents. Her new book is for their children. Your Turn is about how to become an adult. Here and Now begins at 1 on KUAF. Legislation banning medical treatment for transgendered minors in Arkansas that was vetoed Monday by Governor Asa Hutchinson will be law after both chambers of the state legislature voted to override the veto yesterday afternoon. In Arkansas, a simple majority is required to override. House Bill 1570, sponsored by Representative Robin Lundstrom of Elm Springs, bans certain surgeries and hormone treatments for people younger than 18. The governor vetoed the bill this week, calling it an overreach. Arkansas's COVID-19 numbers remain about in the same place where they have been for the past couple of weeks. The Arkansas Department of Health is reporting 163 new cases from the most recent 24 hours of testing and an additional 5 deaths. Active cases dropped slightly by 5, and the number of people hospitalized increased by 7. Washington County reports 33 new cases, the most in the state. Benton County has 17 new cases, the third most. We'll hear highlights from Governor Asa Hutchinson's press briefing regarding COVID-19 held yesterday later on today's show. The Rogers Lowell Chamber of Commerce will host its 99th annual celebration of business and community virtually tomorrow morning. The 30-minute event scheduled to begin on the Chamber's Facebook page and YouTube channel, and it will feature a song especially for the community performed by Barrett Baber. In a letter to members, Raymond Burns, the president and CEO of the Chamber, writes the event is an opportunity to acknowledge the region's ability to be resilient during the year-long pandemic. The Arkansas Razorback men's basketball team ends the season with its highest ranking of the year. In the final USA Today coaches poll released yesterday afternoon, the Razorbacks are 6th. The final ranking comes after Arkansas survived into the elite round of the NCAA tournament and played eventual champion Baylor as close as any team in the field. It's the first time since 2015 the Razorbacks have been in the final poll. The first time since 1995 Arkansas has been ranked in the final top 10 in the poll. And the number one ranked Razorback baseball team, now 23-4, after last night's 7-2 win over Little Rock. Same two teams are scheduled for a 4 o'clock first pitch today. Meanwhile, the 6th ranked Arkansas softball team also won last night, defeating Missouri State 9-1. The Razorbacks hit 6 home runs, the most in a single game in program history, and in the process set a new record for most home runs in a season, 69. Clouds tonight, lows from 45 to 48. Tomorrow, some morning cloudiness in northwest Arkansas with, eventually, sunny conditions across the region. Afternoon highs tomorrow from 70 to 76. This is Ozarks at Large. Early voting for a special election in Bentonville is underway. Election Day proper is April 13th, and voters are being asked to consider a bond extension that would support infrastructure and public safety improvement projects. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
Voters are deciding whether to extend an existing city 1-cent sales tax to finance several projects. This is a bond extension previously approved by voters in 2003 and 2007. Bentonville Mayor Stephanie Orman says the proposed projects are needed to support her growing city.
The city of Bentonville is the 6th fastest growing city in the U.S., according to the U.S. Census Bureau. So we are growing, and to meet those challenges with roads and drainage and different issues, we do need the community support to be able to bring these projects to fruition.
Voters will see 9 questions on their ballot. One deals with the extension of the sales and use tax. If approved, the tax will be extended to 2046 and will again authorize the tax to be used to repay bonds and provide funds for ongoing capital improvements. A second question looks at refinancing. For the city to proceed with the current bond financing plan, the existing bonds need to be approved for refunding by the voters. The ballot amount being voted on is $23 million. Refunding the existing bonds and issuing new debt for the remaining amount would allow the city to issue the new bonds using the existing 1% sales tax. Both of these issues must be approved by voters in order to finance the proposed projects. The seven remaining ballot questions focus on specific projects, and each issue must be approved on its own. One of those issues is seeking approval for nearly $20 million for drainage improvement projects, while another ballot question is focused on generating more than $173 million for street improvements. As part of Bentonville's master street plan, engineers have conducted a citywide need study that identified and ranked projects by safety, congestion reduction, and pedestrian movements, among other factors.
Ultimately, we're trying to move traffic and we're trying to do it in the safest way possible. And so when they hear that and they hear kind of some of the design thoughts behind these things, I think they really start to understand. And we have to be proactive in that arena. And that is our number. That is the project that we're requesting the most funding for is transportation and roads.
City officials are also asking voters to consider approving $3.9 million for a fire training and burning facility and $1.65 million for a police training center. Neither of these facilities currently exist in Bentonville.
One of the questions we got was, you know, could there be a regional facility or something that could be shared within the region? And I certainly appreciate that question and understand it. But most of the larger cities around us already have these facilities in place. And the other thing, when you're talking about a training center and you're taking your police or your fire out of your city, they are your emergency responders. And so you do typically like to have them trained in your own city. So if they do have to respond, they're in your city.
If approved by voters, more than $33 million would be directed toward parks and recreation projects. City officials are also planning to direct nearly $5 million for improvements to the public library, which is celebrating its 15th year at its South Main location this fall. Proposed design features include expanding the children's department, reimagining the teen zone, and creating an activity room.
It's meant to be sort of multi-purpose, to where you can do everything from sewing to arts and crafts to robotics and coding in it. And so that it's kind of what the public said they would like to see. And then it also expands with some community and meeting rooms. And then it has, we wanted to incorporate the outdoors into our public library. That's very important to us in this area. And I always tell people, we are the natural state. So incorporating that's always a good thing. And so it has some opportunity to do expansion outdoors as well.
City officials have created a website with information about the election and are hosting public meetings. Mayor Orman says she hopes they've been as transparent as possible about the process and have provided voters with the necessary information.
About 75% of infrastructure is funded by the local municipality. And so I think that's another really important piece of this. We do need the community support, and we're trying to put this together with as much information as possible.
The Bentonville special election is scheduled for April 13th. Early voting at the Benton County Clerk's Bentonville office is open from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. through Friday and again on Monday. On Election Day, registered voters can cast their vote from 7:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. at Bentonville Church of Christ or First Landmark Baptist Church. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
City officials are hosting a public meeting about the bond election at 6 o'clock Thursday evening at the Bentonville Community Center. There will be limited seating for 50 guests. Residents can also register to participate via Zoom. More information about the meeting, as well as details about each ballot question, can be found at bentonvillebond.com. And more from Bentonville ahead on this Wednesday edition of Ozarks, as we go to the city square to meet Wheezy, a California-born muralist now living in Detroit, but right now painting in downtown Bentonville.
So it's a way for me to translate the small image of the mock-up from digital to on the wall, to mural. Yeah, and so we do the grid with a chalk line, like a construction chalk line, and we do the horizontals and the verticals at specific intervals. For this one, it was 2 feet, every 2 feet.
Wheezy explains making bigger than life, public art. That's ahead on today's show. This is Ozarks at Large. Hospitals in Northwest Arkansas count 17 patients in COVID-19 wards in Washington and Benton counties as of late yesterday. That's a significant drop from the early January average of 128 COVID patients per day. The reductions in patients with the virus is representative of similar decreases experienced across the state. But one of the themes of yesterday's regular COVID briefing with Governor Asa Hutchinson was, don't get complacent. The governor says he's encouraged that all of the virus numbers this spring have been lower than they were in the winter, but that there are still many reasons for concern.
I ask Dr. Romero and Dr. Delahaye, do we still have community spread of COVID-19 in Arkansas? And the answer was yes. And that's just a reminder to us that when you think about 163 Arkansans that we have tested positive for COVID-19, you multiply that by a higher number that are likely to be infected in Arkansas, just haven't been tested, then you're getting to see a number that you have to be mindful that COVID-19 is still in our communities. And whenever we're getting people vaccinated, you don't want to catch COVID-19 when the vaccination is available to you.
The governor says he's watching increasing numbers of COVID-19 variants being detected in more than a dozen states and several countries in Europe. He says the race to get enough people vaccinated is in high gear, and he understands that with the relaxing of things like the mask mandate and the shared images of a sold-out baseball stadium in Arlington, Texas last week, that some people could have a sense the pandemic is over. But he says the variants loom.
And we recognize, based upon historic patterns, that could come to Arkansas. And the only way to prevent that is to beat the spread of COVID through more vaccinations. So vaccinations are critically important. We want to get them out as fast as we can. We have to overcome resistance. We have to overcome the challenges of a rural state. And so while we're making a great deal of progress there, everything we can do to accelerate that, and so that people do not take it for granted that we have low cases, some of the restrictions are off, all the restrictions are off. You see people going to Major League Baseball opening day with the Texas Rangers, and so people relax and they think it's not something we need to worry about. It is, and we still need to get vaccinated.
The other theme of yesterday's briefing, making sure vaccines are available to minority and underserved populations in the state and to people living in the most rural parts of Arkansas. Dr. Michelle Smith, the director of the Office of Health Equity at the Arkansas Department of Health, says task force are trying to make sure vaccines are made available to everybody.
As vaccine distribution continues, ensuring racial equity is important for mitigating the disproportionate impacts on people of color, preventing widening health disparities, and achieving broad population immunity. To that end, in January, we developed health equity strike teams to assist state efforts in ensuring special populations have equal access to vaccine distribution sites. These populations include racial and ethnic minorities, people living with disabilities, faith-based organizations, rural communities, and elderly populations. Teams are dispatched into counties that have low vaccination rates, and they work with local leaders, including mayors, state representatives, church leaders, and civic groups.
Dr. Smith says the health equity strike team includes nurses, public information specialists, and volunteers. She says Black sorority and fraternity groups across the state are also helping publicize opportunities for vaccinations. The ADH reports while 15% of Arkansas's population is Black, only about 10% of all vaccines have been administered to Black residents. Governor Hutchinson says more than 45% of the state's population 65 and over is now fully vaccinated, and another 19% partially vaccinated. All Arkansans 16 and older are now eligible for a shot, and there is a vaccine hotline that's been established to help people schedule vaccinations, 1-800-985-6030. And Arkansas Secretary of Health, Dr. Jose Romero, says it is critical that people needing two shots finish the vaccine procedure properly after receiving the first dose.
If you have received either the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccine, remember only the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is a single-dose vaccine. We're starting to see increasing numbers of individuals that aren't returning or have missed their second dose, and we want them to please catch up on that. Now, even if you miss your window, you can call the 1-800 number and we can tell you where to go to get that second dose. It's very important that you become fully immunized with the vaccine.
The entire briefing, including an update on how schools are handling testing week from Arkansas Secretary of Education Johnny Key, can be found at the governor's YouTube channel. A renewed effort to get people vaccinated is underway not only in Arkansas, but across the country and in Oklahoma. This morning, we talked with Dr. Douglas Drevets, an infectious disease expert at the University of Oklahoma, about work to make sure people there know the vaccines are safe and readily available.
Most states are offering vaccinations to all adults, and I believe that according to the presidential notation, by April 16th, all states will be doing that.
There are some people that are still hesitant, and we have some specific populations that might be more hesitant in general than others. What can you tell folks to assure them that getting vaccinated is not only safe, but the right thing to do?
There are a lot of reasons to get vaccinated. I guess the things that I would tell folks are, you know, first of all, I've been an infectious diseases physician for over 30 years. You know, I'm in an academic practice. I teach. I do research. And so I hope that I have folks' confidence in this arena. Secondly, I would say, you know, I've been vaccinated. My wife has been vaccinated. My mother, who lives in a long-term care facility and a memory care facility, has been vaccinated. I have advocated vaccines for my family and friends. So I'm doing what I ask other peoples to do. There is also huge amounts of data coming both from the U.S. and internationally on how safe and how effective these vaccines are. Many people may know that the country of Israel has been very forward with vaccinating their population. And the data coming out of Israel are put together in millions of people, and they are just astounding at how effective the vaccine is at not only preventing symptomatic infection, but also at preventing asymptomatic carriage. And then there are studies all over the world, again, showing that each of the vaccines is effective at preventing serious illness, preventing death and hospitalizations. And, you know, in the United States, we have vaccinated, I think, over 150 million individuals have been vaccinated. In Oklahoma, we are well over a million. And I suspect the same is true in Arkansas. So many of your friends, your neighbors, perhaps even your healthcare professionals that you go see have also been vaccinated. And nobody is growing a third head. You know, we're still walking, talking, and, you know, doing our jobs. So, you know, I hope to be able to give people confidence.
In Arkansas, we have now nearly 50% of people 65 and older, those who are among the most vulnerable to COVID-19 vaccinated, another 19% of those 65 and older partially vaccinated. I guess some people might think, well, look, the most vulnerable, those 65 and over, those with comorbidities, yes, they need to get vaccinated, but you know, I'm in my 20s or 30s and it's not as bad for me. Why should I get vaccinated? How would you respond to that?
Well, first of all, even though folks are at low risk, that doesn't mean that folks are at no risk. And now what is being seen in places like Michigan and I think upper states of in New England, you know, that many people over the age of 65 have been vaccinated. And so now it's folks under the age of 65 who are the ones who are being the predominantly the ones who are getting hospitalized. So even though the folks are at low risk, there is not no risk. Even with vaccine and natural infection going through the community to provide herd immunity, so to speak, I think it's important for people who are at even low risk themselves to not only think about their own health, but think about the health of the community, because you don't know who you're going to be around. There are people in your own peer group, perhaps, who are immune suppressed, who have risk factors for severe COVID that you may not know of. And so with these respiratory viruses, people don't give consent, in a sense, to get infected by your breath. You breathe and other people get infected. And you really never know what's going on in somebody else's life. Thirdly, you know, eventually you may want to go to a place, you may want to travel, particularly internationally, where vaccine coverage is not so good. And then you would be putting yourself at more risk, as well as putting other people in the community at risk where you're, say, a tourist or a traveler or perhaps working overseas. So I see lots and lots of upside to getting vaccination, and there's very, very little on the downside. It's inconvenient. It will give you a sore shoulder. Oftentimes, if you get the mRNA vaccine, the second one really makes you feel ill for a day or two. You can be fatigued, but then you're done with it. So I think the downsides are low, the upsides are high. And at the end of the day, with all of these public health type measures, it is a risk-benefit ratio. And so even with folks who are in various low-risk health groups, so to speak, there is still a positive risk-benefit ratio for them to get the vaccine.
If you're trying to convince someone who is skeptical for whatever reason, be it political, cultural, or whatever, and let's say I do not have an infectious disease expert with me to back me up, are there any tips you have for what lay people can say to other lay people that you haven't already explained to us to urge and encourage people to get vaccinated?
Yes, a few of the tips are, first of all, be sympathetic and try to understand where they're coming from. And obviously, you want to listen and hear what they're saying. Number two, you do not want to be pejorative or talking down to people. You also don't want to shame them, in a sense, and tell them, you know, they're a bad person and egocentric and selfish by not doing that. So I think it's important to have sympathy for people's positions, even if they're not the same ones that you have, and try to understand where they're coming from. Thirdly, everybody can educate themselves about the positive aspects of the vaccine. The information, particularly good information, is out there. The CDC website has a lot of data, a lot of good information. The National Institutes of Health has good information. There are many others that are doing that. Many national media outlets, such as Wall Street Journal, New York Times, depending on what you like to read, has good information on it, so we can all be educated. Lastly, I would say that, you know, bottom line is it is safe, it is effective, and that it has been studied. The initial phase 3 studies were done in tens of thousands of people, and now the vaccine has been given to tens of millions of people. So there is a huge body of evidence showing how effective they are. And, you know, it's tough to convince somebody who doesn't want to be convinced. And sometimes it's going to take a kind of a personal episode, a personal contact with the vaccine, the loss of a loved one, to really get them to open their eyes. So I have sympathy for people who have questions, and I understand that. It's natural for people to have questions. So we need to listen to them and give them the best evidence possible. And at the end of the day, it's up to them.
Dr. Douglas Drevets is an infectious disease expert at the University of Oklahoma and a representative of the Infectious Diseases Society of America. He spoke with us this morning about efforts to encourage people to become vaccinated across the country in Oklahoma and in Arkansas.
KUAF is supported by Park Lane Family Dental, offering dental wellness with an emphasis on restorative and cosmetic dentistry for more than 30 years. With offices in Fort Smith and Rogers, Park Lane follows CDC-recommended protocol for COVID prevention. ParkLaneDental.com for information or to schedule an appointment.
This is Ozarks at Large. USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service is proposing removing the term karst from its National Handbook of Conservation Practices. That's raising a ruckus among environmentalists. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
Dane Schumacher is a resident of southeastern rural Carroll County. He's been in what can only be described as a number of karst skirmishes. He's helped to successfully shut down an industrial hog farm in Newton County, block a utility from freely spraying herbicide on private property rights of ways, and prevent a massive turkey CAFO or confined animal feeding operation from being built in his watershed, all of those situated on karst.
Yes, I just really care for our environment and the beauty that we have here, the landscape, the clean water, and all of it where I live, is the predominant feature is karst.
On the Ozarks, karst is a predominantly soluble limestone geologic formation beneath a thin layer of soil through which surface water has drained for millennia, dissolving and carving subsurface channels, streams, caves, and sinkholes.
What ecological service that does the karst provide? I think it provides us with an abundance of springs flowing off of different bluffs. There's caverns which provide an abundance of subterranean ecosystem, which it also is a very good indicator for a healthy, strong environment. There are bats. Caves can be homes to bats, different types of insects, salamanders, which are all good litmus for the health and the quality of our water system.
The Ozarks Plateau contains a motherlode of spring-saturated karst, which more federal and state agencies recognize as sensitive ecological preserves. But karst, due to its nature, is also vulnerable to surface pollution. Yet the USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service, headquartered in Washington, D.C., is asking the public to comment on its notice to remove the word karst associated with sinkholes from its Handbook of Conservation Practices.
The purpose of the handbook is to provide technical guidance to NRCS participants, whether that be financial assistance, technical assistance, but it's a guide for conservation practices.
NRCS, formerly known as the Soil Conservation Service, provides technical assistance to farmers and private land owners and managers. Schumacher, a former paralegal turned citizen scientist and environmental consultant, queried the Conservation Service to learn why the agency wants to delete the word karst.
Exactly that. Why are you removing the word karst and all terminology, including geologic investigations and concerns and considerations, in the current document? And he forwarded my email to the lead technical assistant or technician, and I did get a response from her, and I can read it to you real quick if you'd like. Sinkholes are typically, you were correct in that, naturally occurring sinkholes are typically associated with karst processes. There are other environmental settings than karst terrain that can cause naturally occurring sinkholes. For example, depressions at the land surface and glacial till caused by a decline in the water table or collapsed lava tubes. For the conservation practice standard to be applicable to all environmental settings where naturally occurring sinkholes form, in this update, the standard name was changed from karst sinkhole treatment to sinkhole treatment, and the term karst was removed where the standard addresses all environmental settings where naturally occurring sinkholes form.
Schumacher says the karst sinkhole designation was established only 5 years ago by the federal agency.
Over 20% of the landmass in the United States is comprised of karst.
And most sinkholes, he says, occur in karst topography, given its fragile nature, requiring developers, farmers, property owners, and communities to plant appropriately to protect karst regions. Schumacher says the proposal to delete the word raised red flags for him.
Primarily because we are dealing with some loose and lax regulatory process that might not catch or might not investigate at the beginning, at the site evaluation, when a particular facility wants to be sited. There are ways to circumvent so that you wouldn't have to go through any kind of investigative process to determine whether your facility will sit atop karst or not.
Schumacher encourages anyone interested in maintaining karst designations in Natural Resource Conservation Services literature to comment. The deadline is April 8th. Search regulations.gov/comments/NRCS. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And we've posted the NRCS public comment link at ozarksatlarge.com. Arkansas is the first state in the nation to ban transgender health care to minors. Yesterday, the Arkansas legislature, by a simple majority, overturned a veto issued the previous day by Governor Asa Hutchinson of a bill banning gender-affirming medical care for trans youth in the state. The bill's sponsor, State Representative Robin Lundstrom of Elm Springs, spoke one more time on the House floor about HB 1570, the Save Adolescents from Experimentation Act.
We've been through this bill, so I won't hit every single point. But I do think it's important to hit a few things that have been discussed. First of all, I want to thank a few folks. I want to thank Family Council, Family Research Council, Heritage Foundation, Focus on the Family.
Leading up to the vote, she made a closing case.
They're minors and they're children, and they need to be protected from two things, both surgical and chemical sex change procedures.
Gender confirmation surgery is legal for trans adults in Arkansas, but not for trans youth. The SAFE Act bars healthcare providers from prescribing gender-affirming hormone treatment to Arkansas minors seeking to transition.
The question before the House is the passage of House Bill 1570, the objections of the governor notwithstanding. Has everyone voted? Has everyone voted? Cast up the ballot, Mr. Clerk. By a vote of 72 yeas, 25 nays, and zero present, House Bill 1570 is passed, the objections of the governor notwithstanding.
After the Arkansas House voted to overturn Governor Hutchinson's veto yesterday, the Arkansas Senate immediately followed, voting 25-8 to override. Governor Hutchinson says the SAFE Act is too extreme and exemplifies what he calls vast government overreach. The governor expressed hope that conservative lawmakers would follow suit, saying he's learned in recent weeks from constituents that gender-affirming health care can save young lives. This is Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The 45th annual Hogeye Marathon is Saturday, April 24th and 25th in downtown Springdale. This full and half marathon, 5K and 10K run, plus four-person marathon relay will benefit several local charities. Finisher medals will be awarded. The online registration deadline is April 22nd. HogEyeMarathon.com for information.
Late last week in Bentonville, we met up with Louise Jones, or her artistic name, Wheezy. She's an artist specializing in public art murals. Born in California, she now lives in Detroit and is spending a couple of weeks in Bentonville, commissioned by Oz Art NWA and Just Kids, to create a work at 2nd and Main Streets. Wheezy's murals are lush replicas of flowers and can be found around her adopted city of Detroit, but also in Buffalo, Ohio, and elsewhere. When we met her Friday afternoon, masked and socially distant, the work in progress was a two-story maze of squares, slight outlines, and a grid of numbers and letters. We asked her about the art and science of creating larger-than-life public art.
So when you have a location, whether it's in Detroit or Buffalo or Ohio or here, do you get a picture of the building before you ever see it physically?
Absolutely, yeah. If it's out of town, I will, even if it's in Detroit, I'll always get a photo sent before I move forward just to see if it's a good fit. Because, I try to take in the architecture as part of the work of art, you know? Yeah.
Well, so I am so intrigued by the marks, the squares, and what they mean.
Yeah, so it's a way for me to translate the small image of the mock-up from digital to on the wall, to mural. Yeah, and so we do the grid with a chalk line, like a construction chalk line, and we do the horizontals and the verticals at specific intervals. For this one, it was 2 feet, every 2 feet. And it's sort of just however big or small you want the grid, it depends on the artist. For me, this is actually smaller than I would usually have it. I could have gone to 3 feet and that would have been okay, but I'm working with an assistant this time that I've never worked with before. So the more precise I am with the grid, the easier it is for us to communicate about putting it, you know, up on the wall. And then because it's a chalk line, it's impermanent. So if it rains, then it will wash away, which is why we put the extra plus marks and numbers to indicate where things are. But also the numbers, or so you don't get lost in the grid. You know what I'm saying? So, like, I can holler at my assistant and be like, hey, can you work on, like, A or, like, 2A, and I'll be over here at, like, 10Z or something, you know? So, and then when we ran out of the capital letters, we just went to lowercase letters, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, speaking of getting lost, because you might be on one end of this two-story building.
Yeah.
Someone might, your assistant might be on the other end. You might be on the lift. They might be kneeling on the ground.
Yeah.
How often do you have to kind of step back and look at the whole picture?
Quite often, yeah. On a wall like this, it's easier to step off the lift and walk across the street. So I do it as much as I can because that's a luxury. But on a larger wall where there's more time getting from the wall down to the ground, then I'll just save it for, you know, lunch, you know, to go down and look at it. Yeah, yeah.
Is there ever a surprise between the digital incarnation and then when you get in front of the edifice for the first time?
Absolutely, yeah. Not so much a surprise for the client, maybe, because they might not notice the differences, but I might notice something where this is more difficult to achieve because there's a window where I didn't expect it, or the wall bumps out at a certain angle. So, yeah, there are surprises, but I have learned to be resourceful, yeah.
In a way, creating a mural seems like juggling or eating fire, because how do you do it the first time?
It's scary. It's extremely scary. When I first did it, I was in my young 20s, and I was very, confident and fearless, and I had friends that were egging me on, so I just tried not to overthink it, and I think that's just my personality as well, yeah, because you have to take a leap of faith. You do.
Do people come by and ask you what you're doing?
Oh, all the time, yes. I get lots of comments. One that is pretty popular on this project is that it looks like paint by numbers.
Because of the numbers.
Because of the numbers. And I also get, you missed a spot a lot. but yeah, people are really into it. And flowers especially are universally loved. So, yeah.
So your work with flowers is beautiful. It's vibrant. How did that become your subject of choice?
Well, it came about in college. I started painting wallpapers into my paintings. I just started really enjoying the design of textiles and wallpapers, floral. And then that became my concentration. You know, in college, in art school, you kind of have to pick something and stick with it, and it's kind of like a thesis. So that was sort of the subject matter that I chose, and then I just went with it. And it went from small illustrations incorporating textiles and wallpapers to large compositions focusing on local native plants. It just evolved naturally because local and native plants, I can go to the location for a site visit and I can pick a bouquet and it could be specific to that time and place, you know, and it becomes very meaningful and very special, especially to the people who see the mural every day, you know?
Nothing is permanent, of course, but there is a sense of existence when you create a mural.
Of course.
You will leave.
Yes.
And thousands of people will come by day after day.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. It's it adds to people's commute, you know, and people see it out of their window and it becomes part of their landscape, you know, and that is wonderful to me. That was more of a comment than a question, wasn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
Are you able to not be self-critical when you're done and you walk away? If you go back to a city 2, 5, 10 years later, you're okay?
I am not okay, usually. I'm never okay. I'm always so self-critical. I don't know if I'll ever get over that. There are some murals that I go back and I'm very satisfied, and there's nothing I would do to change. I still remember things that I was self-conscious about leaving it, but I'm content enough where I enjoy seeing them again. There are some murals from early on in my career where I can't even look at them. I tried, and some of them are in Detroit actually, and I try to avoid them. But I've talked to other people and other people have a better opinion about them. But yeah, I'm always self-critical.
Do you sign them?
I do, yeah. I always sign them. at the top usually, either on the left or the right, and I sign it with my artist moniker, which is O-U-I-Z-I, Wheezy, yeah.
You don't have a problem with heights, I'm taking it.
I do not, but I'm definitely still afraid of them sometimes, yeah. But I can get over it for the work, yeah.
We say respectful. You're respectful of them.
I am respectful of them, definitely. But I am so conscious of safety. If I am on a boom lift, I'll wear a harness, you know, and I'll always lock the chain gate on a scissor lift, and I don't play around, no. It's serious, very serious.
And what I love about your subject is they're always in bloom. If I come by in January, they're in bloom. If I come back in 2035, they're in bloom.
Yeah, yeah, and that's we have to really appreciate these things when we live in places with seasons. I grew up in California, and we don't have seasons, so I never could appreciate flowers fully until I moved to Michigan. And now there's a whole nother level of respect, you know, for the amazing miracle of plants, you know.
Okay, it's the last couple of hours of a project. Are you at all nostalgic, or are you ready to move on?
It's a little bit of both. It depends on the project. But some projects, I do them with other artists from all over the world, and I get really sad because I know I'm not going to see them again for a long time or ever again. Like when I went to New Zealand, I was like, I don't even know if I'm ever going to come back, you know? So I definitely cried a lot when I left that. But some projects, I'm all alone, and it was very physically taxing, so I can't wait to go home and sleep in my own bed.
What's one more thing I should have asked that I don't know about creating a mural?
That's a good question. I think you asked pretty much every question. One thing that I didn't touch upon was that you can't go to school for painting murals, but in 5 years, I think you can, because, yeah, I'm starting to actually do workshops for schools, like schools that I wish I had gone to, but I couldn't have qualified at the time, now are asking me to do lectures, and I'm my mind is completely blown, you know? I feel so humbled by that.
Louise Jones, a.k.a. Wheezy, is creating a two-story mural at 2nd and Main in downtown Bentonville. We talked with her last Friday afternoon. The art is a partnership with Oz Art NWA and Just Kids. You can find examples of her art elsewhere at her website, WheezyArt/murals. Wheezy spelled O-U-I-Z-I. Let's move from a busy downtown Bentonville Square to Lee Creek at Devil's Den. It has already been another long, loud week. It's just Wednesday, and we all need a break. So let's spend a half minute or so with the sun rising in Devil's Den and some waking waterfowl from this past Easter weekend. Sounds of Lee Creek at Devil's Den this weekend. This is Ozarks at Large.
Hello, my name is Rhonda Dillard, and I'm the KUF Underwriting Director. Did you know that KUF listeners are connected at home, on the road, and at the office? Your business can connect with these listeners by sponsoring programming on this public radio station. Find out more about KUF underwriting opportunities by emailing Rhonda at KUAF.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. Calls to Arkansas's child abuse hotline have increased as coronavirus restrictions have been lifted. David Monteith, with our partner station KUAR in Little Rock, reports on how the pandemic has had an impact identifying and supporting abused children.
Last April, when much of the state shut down in response to the pandemic, calls to Arkansas's child abuse hotline dropped significantly. Teachers, the group most likely to spot and report suspected maltreatment, had shifted to virtual classrooms and were having less interaction with students. Dan Mack, administrator of the Arkansas State Police's Crimes Against Children hotline, says there were nearly 3,000 fewer calls than normal last April. But that has changed in recent months.
Schools have opened up, so more virtual students are now attending in person, especially after the this last Christmas break. So we're seeing a kind of a steady increase.
Max says the hotline received nearly 10,000 fewer calls in 2020 compared to the year before. As experts feared, that didn't mean abuse declined, just the reporting. There are 17 children's advocacy centers in the state that offer a range of support for abused children and their caregivers. Elizabeth Pulley, the organization's executive director, says the number of in-person visits increased even as calls decreased. Children's advocacy centers also provide training to help people, like teachers, identify potentially abusive situations. When schools went virtual, Pulley says the centers looked for additional resources and partners.
Delivery services, if it was a FedEx or UPS or food delivery, those were still going to people's houses. And are they aware? What are signs? Did they see something odd? And, just really kind of looking at different ways to get our foot in the door to talk about child abuse, how to use the hotline.
Max says those new partnerships may have contributed to a change in the types of people reporting abuse.
We did see an increase of calls being made by delivery personnel or personnel who are making service calls. They may have been maybe a cable provider, or maybe they were a plumber, or they were a maintenance person in an apartment complex.
Similar to the advocacy centers, Dr. Karen Farst, a pediatrician who specializes in child abuse cases at Arkansas Children's Hospital, says the number of children being seen for abuse at the hospital didn't decrease last year. Farst says there were even small increases in some types of maltreatment cases.
The other thing that we've seen in the short run that we kind of need to keep following it forward, but the severity of cases over really kind of the calendar year of 2020 was higher than the severity of cases for calendar year 2019.
As more of the state gets vaccinated and pandemic restrictions are relaxed, reports of maltreatment are expected to continue rising. Farst says support organizations like the Department of Human Services will be focused on improving the circumstances for families to prevent repeated abuse.
I think a lot of people think that when DHS takes custody of a child, that that's just kind of it, and the family has lost the child. But there's actually a lot of work that goes into a case if a child comes into custody to try to improve the family situation, strengthen things, and try to get that family back together, because we know that kids will do better in the long run if they can safely be with their family.
Since 1983, April has been National Child Abuse Prevention Month. Arkansans who suspect a child is being abused can call the state hotline at 1-800-482-5964 or 1-844-728-3224. In Little Rock, I'm David Monteith.
This is Ozarks at Large. The 2021 report, Rural Profile of Arkansas, indicates while the overall state population grew by about 3% between 2010 and 2019, the state's rural population shrank by about 3.3% during that same period. Arkansas remains more rural than the national average. In 2019, about 41% of the state's population lived in what are defined as rural areas. The biennial report is published by the University of Arkansas System Division of Agriculture. The Bentonville Farmers Market returns Saturday. Seniors and shoppers considered high risk for COVID-19 are encouraged to be in the market between 7:30 and 8:30 a.m. Tents will be at least 10 feet apart. All vendors will be wearing masks. There will be 4 designated areas to enter, and in most of the areas of the market, just one side of the street will be utilized. There will be signs encouraging masks, social distancing, and limited shopping time. And there will be limited opportunities for fans to watch the home outdoor track and field meets this spring at the University of Arkansas. The U of A Athletic Department announced yesterday limited spectator attendance will be allowed in the east grandstands with socially distanced seating options. The John McDonnell Invitational, scheduled for April 23rd and 24th. The Arkansas Twilight Meet, set for May 7th. Tickets for both events went on sale this morning.
It's the Community Spotlight on KUAF. I'm Pete Hartman. Today on the line, we're speaking with Mary Thompson. She's Executive Director of Apple Seeds NWA. Mary, nice to talk to you for the first time.
Yes, we're excited to talk with you too, Pete. Yes, Apple Seeds is a nonprofit in Fayetteville, Arkansas. We focus on connecting kids with where their food comes from. Our mission is to inspire healthy living through garden-based education.
You know, in the past year, with the pandemic, of course, has affected schools in so many different ways. Real quickly, kind of touch on how it has kind of affected how y'all do what you do.
So instead of having field trips and cooking classes with students on the farm, we're really shifting towards all of the wonderful things that videography has to offer to highlight the food and the farm. So we are doing virtual field trips, as well as a YouTube channel that has short cooking classes for kids that they can engage with at any time.
Speaking with Mary Thompson, Executive Director of Apple Seeds NWA. Okay, anything on the horizon, events, what's going on?
Yes, we are excited to be opening our doors to have outside events this spring. And we're opening up a new series that we haven't done before called The Wild Table, which is a series of workshops and dinners that explore how to source and curate food from wild resources, both responsibly and sustainably. So we are really excited to be pulling together local experts in foraging, culinary arts, hunting and angling, as well as nutrition, and sharing what they have to offer in the form of a workshop, and then pairing it with a culinary artist for a dinner, following it with a curated meal.
As you mentioned, this is going to be a series. The first event, though, I know coming up fairly soon, right?
Yes, the first one's on April 11th. We'll be focusing on early spring foraging. We'll have local expert Bo Brown, who's the author of Foraging in the Ozarks.
This series will then continue April 25th with a program focusing on venison and options for wild proteins. Then later in the summer, a program all about trout, deboning, smoking, curing, and cooking over a fire. Oh, gosh. Okay, now I'm hungry. Mary Thompson, Executive Director of Apple Seeds NWA. So much cool things going on. Again, remind us the best way to get information on y'all.
Our website, appleseedsnwa.org, is the best place to find everything that's happening.
All right, Mary, thanks for letting us know what's coming up this spring.
Thank you, Pete.
The Community Spotlight from your public radio station, KUAF. Local matters.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Blue Mountain. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. Contributors to our Wednesday edition of Ozarks at Large included Antoinette Grajeda, Jacqueline Froelich, who also provided us sounds of the override of the governor's veto in the Arkansas House yesterday, and Timothy Dennis produced today's show back at his home studio in downtown Fayetteville. The Community Spotlight is produced by Pete Hartman inside the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio. Additional help today provided by our friends and colleagues at KUAR, Public Radio for Little Rock and Central Arkansas. Our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. It's titled First Hurrah. You can find it and much more music from Daryl wherever you go online to find music. Want to repeat the toll-free number, that is the Arkansas vaccination hotline. That is 1-800-985-6030. 800-985-6030, the hotline that will help you get a vaccination schedule. If you ever miss a daily edition of Ozarks at Large, we have you covered, because you can just ask your smart speaker to please play Ozarks at Large and hear the most recent daily edition. You can also go to our website, ozarksatlarge.com. Full shows there, as well as individual stories and interviews with links that let you share those stories, shows, and interviews with someone you'd like to share them with. And as always, we're available as a podcast through any of the major podcast distributors. All of those services I just mentioned, free. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much. Take care of yourself. We'll talk again soon.